Inclusive leadership is about knowing your people. Do you know people's motivations? Do you know their desires? Do you know their hopes and dreams? That takes a long time. That is not a one-size-fits-all. That requires more effort, but you get the best out of people when you do that. I encourage anyone listening who's doing any kind of policy work, who's doing any kind of decision making on teams, if you are looking at any initiative that involves race, then please include gender. If you're looking at any initiative that involves gender, please think of race. So it's these intersecting identities, and these are just two. You know, there are many more.
Dr. Belissa Green's laser-sharp focus is on evidence-based decision-making. This isn't surprising, as she's an organizational psychologist with a background in academia and cultural change. Her work in defense resulted in significant changes in policy, approach, and leadership thinking. Now working in the world of consultancy, her wisdom is well worth absorbing for all leaders determined to understand better and deliver positive change. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Belissa.
I was born in London, and I'll tell a little story. At the time of the sort of Brixton riots, my father, who was from Trinidad and Tobago, was going back to Trinidad on a holiday, so he said. He then rang my mum after 2 weeks and said, I've got good news and bad news. So the good news is I found a job and they would like me to start next week. The bad news is I'm not going to come back and sort of help pack up, but they're willing to sort of send, you know, send for you all and we could all migrate. So I lived in Trinidad for 14 years. I did all my primary education, secondary education there. So I grew up in an environment where everyone looked like me, where I was expected to thrive, where I had a very normal sort of upbringing, and I didn't have some of the challenges that, say, for example, my son has now. Mm-hmm. That said, I grew up in a Caribbean, West Indian sort of culture. When I joined the army as a civil servant, as an occupational psychologist, one of the things I noticed was that we recruited quite a lot of people from the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. But when I asked questions about the policy of doing this, why did we do this? Was this an effective way of recruiting? What were people's lived experiences? There was a sort of mismatch between some of the things I was seeing and hearing and the policies that we had. And I couldn't get an answer from anyone. Mm. Do we know if they are promoted? Do we know how they're navigating the system? How are they getting home? Things like that. What is their sort of support network like? I remember having a conversation with my line manager at the time, and I said, I've already started a PhD. And I was looking into the lived experiences of Black female police officers. Mm. And I said, look, I would like to switch topics because this is really important. I had full support to do that. And so I set about really trying to help the organization understand the lived experience of these individuals who travel from very far, some of them, and sacrifice a lot to come and work for a great organization such as the Army.
You had already chosen to be an occupational psychologist with the Army. What led you to do that?
I wanted to be a clinical psychologist, though I'm dating myself, Fraser Crane. I used to watch Fraser all the time. I was like, yes, Seattle, we're listening. I was going to have my radio show and help people and all of this kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And when I was working in the NHS doing some placements, you know, as part of my first lot of training, I was more fascinated, confused at the same time, but curious about things like training, things like why certain groups of staff had certain experiences, mm-hmm. why the impact of how teams worked within, you know, these wards, these mental health wards, led to patients coming back because there was a lack of communication and all of this. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, and he said, that's still psychology, but it's a different type of psychology. So this is before the internet, before Google, for anybody listening. I went to the library and they had these big tomes of career books. And I looked it up, and the more I read about organizational psychology and occupational psychology, about sort of working within organizations to really transform these organizations for people, I just knew that that's what I wanted to do, and I haven't looked back since.
And it seems right from the get-go that evidence-based approach is really important for you, and presumably that was what took you to study your PhD.
Yeah.
What was the impact of your PhD?
There was a body of evidence that decision makers could use to think about and to use as a framework for how they would interact with our personnel that were coming from the Commonwealth. So things like dom call leave, a type of leave that our personnel from the Commonwealth can use, which is an extended period of leave. I believe it's about sort of 5 weeks that they are entitled to after a certain number of years in the organization. It was 5 years at the time. There was a conversation about whether or not this time frame was fair, whether it was equitable, whether it was appropriate. And prior to me doing my PhD, there was no real evidence to support that conversation. Once I had done it, the beautiful thing about it, that it wasn't used by policymakers. Policymakers didn't sort of pick up my PhD and go, oh, yes, we now have some evidence. Let's change this policy. It was Commonwealth personnel themselves who found the work, who went over the work, who used it to say, well, look, you know, is this fair? You know, is it that, you know, we have a different experience? You know, we're trying to be equitable here. And that policy was reviewed. Another significant impact of the work that I did was something that I didn't know until very recently, when I attended the Army Multicultural Conference in September 2023. The employee resource group for personnel who are from multicultural backgrounds in the Army held a conference in September of 2023. And the amount of people who came up to me and told me that they felt seen in that work was quite surprising, because I hadn't had access to that. No one had sort of told me. It kind of, you know, you do your PhD, you put it out into the big wide world, and sometimes people read it, sometimes people don't. Just having people see themselves in the work that I've done is significant, because they feel less alone and they feel validated. And they're able to have conversations with their sort of line managers or their peers about this experience. And it's not just an individual experience. This is the experience of a group of people.
Winding the clock forward, you then moved into what I guess is the policy space in the Army's diversity and inclusion team. Did you see that culture change and the increased understanding and awareness when you moved into that job?
So there was a focus on culture. When I took over the team in sort of 2020, there was a big focus on culture and understanding how people wanted to show up in the organization and what teamwork would look like. What I was able to do was to be able to have conversations with very senior leaders about evidence and the need to not knee-jerk about changes in culture, changes in policy. It was very much about how do we use evidence to make better decisions for all of our people. And also this question of being seen and being heard. If you were a sort of 17-year-old soldier who had just joined the organization, what does culture mean to you? What does diversity and inclusion mean to you? And so this conversation about making things accessible, making people feel seen and heard, was very important. So Operation Teamwork was born out of allowing people to feel seen, allowing people to understand what it actually means to be part of a team, to respect other people within their team in order to operate effectively. Because ultimately, that's what we're trying to do, isn't it?
Developing high-performing teams requires not only those that are from underrepresented groups to be seen and heard, but equally for those that maybe have been exposed to people from underrepresented groups, for them to have some of their blind spots removed, perhaps. So there's an education and a growth part of this as well, which I presume was part of the work.
Yes. And this is the thing about sort of sharing stories and sharing experiences, because you may not hold the same identity as somebody else, but you may be able to relate on something else in terms of, you know, your upbringing, in terms of where you've lived, you know, your parents, you know, where you went to school, your siblings, your family. So this was very much about breaking down artificial barriers and supporting people to learn about other people, but also people feeling comfortable to share that, okay, we are here to work as a team.
One of the first lessons I was taught when I went through my officer training was to know and understand your people, your team, in order then that you can get the best from them. And that's about not just strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
It's also about how to motivate people effectively and not applying a one-size-fits-all approach, because, of course, we're all different.
That's effective leadership. And I talk about inclusive leadership a lot in the work that I do now when I go to organizations and I have those conversations. Inclusive leadership is about knowing your people. Do you know people's motivations? Do you know their desires? Do you know their hopes and dreams? That takes a long time. That is not a one-size-fits-all. That requires more effort. But you get the best out of people when you do that. And inclusive leadership is about being curious. If I were in your team, it would be, well, what's Melissa's experience? What does she do on a weekend? You know, where does she go? You know, what motivates her? What does she want to do in the future? I am then using this information to advocate for your team, to bring them into conversations, to actually bear them in mind. But if you don't know things about your team, then you can't do that. You can't be an effective leader.
I don't think that coaching is for the reserve of a professional coach.
No.
I think it's organic to all leaders in order that they can either signpost their people to how they might want to grow and develop. Do you think that that's right? Or do you think that there's a connectivity that needs to be clear between functions of leaders and executive coaching?
Executive coaching, it's not very common in the public sector. It's the preserve of very senior leaders. It really depends on you as an individual. Coaching, for me, was about and is about providing support and space to reflect and think. If you have the space to do that, you may have a circle of people, you may have an advocate, a sponsor, a mentor. If you don't have that, coaching is an extremely useful way to elevate your leadership, because it provides you with the opportunity to really reflect on your decision making, to reflect on how you show up, what some of your blind spots may be, but also what are your strengths? You know, as a leader, you have strengths. So how do you lean into those? And very often we become leaders because we're good at the job we've done. And so the question then becomes, you know, how are you sharing a vision? Because that's what leadership is about. How do you share your vision with your team? How do you set clear goals and priorities? How do you encourage and engage and motivate your team to actually perform? And also, how do you create psychological safety? And these aren't things that a lot of leaders think about consciously. But, you know, working with a coach allows you that space to do that.
It reminds me of an article you wrote about closing the progression gap. And you talked about how it allows black women a sanctuary to put down their armour and use this space, as you've said, to help grow and develop. Even when there is psychological safety and a good workplace culture, authenticity is hidden by the need to wear armour and that black women have to wear extra layers of armour. Can you unpack that for us a bit?
I can talk about my own experience. Very often, I tend to be the only black person in a space. 99% of the time, I'm the only black woman in a space. My role is to show up as authentically as I can in those spaces, but I need to feel safe. I need to feel able to have conversations, to show who I am, to be able to share my opinion and my voice without fear of intimidation, without fear that I won't be taken seriously. I would say a lot of times, if you are the only person in a space, it's a very lonely space. And you're navigating quite a lot of different thoughts, you're navigating perspectives, you're trying to show up as the best you can, as well as you're trying to be effective at what you do. Now, this question of armoring and covering is about protecting yourself against things like stereotypes, microaggressions, racism. Black women have to contend with an intersecting identity, which is about being black and about being a woman. And more often than not, what we tend to see is this focus on one. In organizations, you know, we want to talk about anti-racism, for example, or we want to talk about the gender pay gap. But what we don't often talk about is, you know, if you are talking about the sort of gender pay gap, you're looking at initiatives for women in your organization, are we understanding the lived experience of women who are not white? Do they have different experiences? Are they navigating the organization the same way? And often what I tend to see in my work is that black women are just putting on that extra layer of armor so that they can deal with some of the things that they have to deal with. A lot of it is invisibility, not being taken seriously, questions that, you know, other women may not be asked, you know, about hair. And I remember one time, so I like to change my hair very frequently. I do it every couple of weeks. And I remember a very senior leader in the organization said to me, "My goodness, Belissa, you know, my wife and daughters change their hair, but this is something else." I kind of blew that off because it didn't really matter. And I said, yes, it's going to happen every 6 weeks. You need to get used to it. But for women who haven't had the experience of dealing with these things frequently and developing some kind of way for coping, so it's a coping strategy, those things may start to affect performance. They are things that, you know, people take on board. They become cumulative. So for me, coaching is about allowing people that space to unpack all of that.
And of course, all of what you've described shouldn't be on you. It's the responsibility of the people in the room to ensure that they are doing all that they can to create the conditions where you don't need to put on all that armor. Are there some practical tips that you could give me to create the conditions to get the best from you?
It goes back to psychological safety. It goes back to feeling, am I able to trust my leader? Am I able to trust my teammates? Now, there's research that has recently been published talking about the fact that if black women particularly are in mixed teams, they perform better. Primarily because there is probably more psychological safety in that team. They don't have to deal with questions every day about their hair or their nails or their children, but also being seen. They're more likely to work with people who share a type of identity or understand, you know, sort of their lived experience. It's about being open. It's about listening. It's not about being afraid to have a conversation. And if we think about being in a group, everybody else is being invited out, and suddenly we're afraid or scared to have a conversation with team members who are from underrepresented groups, we're excluding people through fear. It's always better to ask a question, something you may not be able to ask. So don't ask about hair. Yep. Don't ask about food. If you haven't built the foundations for those conversations, I think, you know, you should veer away from interpersonal conversation. I would encourage leaders to meet people where they are. Be observant about your team members. So what are they interested in? Start there. Start with understanding their lived experience, and then you can progress from there.
And with curiosity comes learning and understanding. Absolutely. And growth. It's really difficult to get the balance right between encouraging, and there was no chastising, but there was a you can do better here. How do you manage that?
It's a balance between getting people to think differently. And as a thought leader in this space, what I always want at the end of an article is for someone to say, huh, I didn't really think about it that way. Or I didn't really even think about it. Chastising or ranting isn't useful for behavior change. And my training as a psychologist is very much around understanding human behavior. I try to play to people's strengths. Mm. If you are a leader in this space, or even if you are a team member, thinking about how you can do better, you're in a good place anyway. The balance is in allowing people the space to do some reflection. You want to challenge them, but you also want to hold that space so that they can do that thinking. I encourage anyone listening who's doing any kind of policy work, who's doing any kind of decision making on teams, if you are looking at any initiative that involves race, then please include gender. If you're looking at any initiative that involves gender, please think of race. So it's these intersecting identities. And these are just two. Yeah. You know, there are many more. Yeah. It's really about encouraging people to think more broadly and to ask the question, am I including everyone here? Mm. Or the question needs to be, who needs to be included in this conversation? Particularly if you lead a team. I would ask you to think about, who are the people that you tend to go to when you have a problem to solve?
I remember very clearly the lived experience report that came out in late 2019, I think it was, that focused on the experience of women and people from underrepresented groups, or both.
I can be both.
You can. You are. There were some really powerful quotations of people's lived experience in there that I found worked really well to reach into the ears of those who weren't from that community or cohort, particularly senior leaders. And of course, some want the hard facts and others want the qualitative data. And some need both. The challenge is, back to knowing your people, it's knowing which is going to work.
Absolutely. And so I am an advocate of using the evidence that's there. If there is a gap, I encourage people to go out and try and close that gap through research. But like you said, I think if you're trying to influence senior leaders in particular, you have to know those leaders as well. And if you know you're working with a leader who does not want to understand the sort of more qualitative aspects and is concerned about numbers, then you need to get that data. You need to get that data, but also you need to have in your back pocket, or you need to have an understanding of the lived experience so that you can contextualize that data, because the numbers don't just sit in a vacuum. They don't sit on their own. So, for example, when I was looking at some data for Black women at work, there were figures around Black women being able to afford a pension. The data suggested that it was more than 50% of Black women did not have a pension. But I wanted to understand, why was this? So we're starting to look into it and understand, so Black women tend to be in a particular type of role, in the caring sector, in a particular type of job. So that would explain why there is a structural barrier to earning a particular amount of money that enables you to have a pension. It's not just about the numbers. The numbers lead to an experience. The numbers lead to a story, and vice versa. So I would encourage anyone who is doing any kind of policy work or decision-making work around equity to be curious.
And then once you've got the evidence and you've done the analysis, that should lead you to initiatives. And that presumably means that one should develop a tailored package of initiatives and solutions that are going to make the difference that you're seeking.
If only it were that easy, Lindsay. We have the evidence and research, and now we're going to just sort of tailor things and make sure that, yes, everything is signed off. I joke, but in an ideal world, yes. But, you know, organizations are messy places. People are complicated. Leaders are making very difficult decisions with the resources they have often. So from my experience with leading the Army D&I team, we had a program of work that we wanted to deliver and that we set out to deliver. There are people that you need to bring along the way. You need to include stakeholders, and also with any initiative in an organization, people need to know what's in it for them. So what's in it for me if I do this particular thing based on the evidence. Okay, we can say, well, that's a good thing. But the question is often, is it going to make this team better, more effective in the private sector? Is this going to help us make more profit? But it's not the end result for the end result's sake. When people show up in organizations and it's a good place to work and they can thrive and they feel safe, they're going to do better. They're going to perform better. And ultimately, you're going to have innovation, creativity, that's going to lead to an enhanced team culture. The opportunities are endless. So being guided by evidence is extremely important, because you don't get those results if initiatives are just kind of based on good ideas, unfortunately.
I think there's a quote about every wind is an ill wind if you don't know which port you're sailing to. So if you've got a program and you know where you're trying to get to, if you do have to tack and take a bit of a route, as long as you know where you're going to, then you're going to make the progress that you're after.
And it's about being intentional. Again, I always come back to that. What are we trying to achieve here? So that you are staying true to your North Star. You know, we are trying to achieve X. So you're always able to have that conversation with decision makers, stakeholders, gatekeepers about what it is the organization is trying to do. So being a trusted advisor, and that's something I also talk quite a bit about and sort of coach leaders around, sometimes the frustrations of delivering initiatives in organizations, even though they have the evidence or it's a great idea. My challenge and pushback is, you know, how are you advising and supporting those that are making the decisions and that are supporting you to deliver this piece of work? So stakeholder management is extremely important. Sometimes we need to consider doing the best we can with what we have, and things may be imperfect. So how can you make change incrementally?
You've worked for some years for the Army, but you're not doing that now. I suspect if I asked you, what have you learned, that we might be here for quite some time. But do you have some highlights of what you've learned? And also, what do you miss, if at all, anything?
Great question. What have I learned and what have I missed? Let me think about that. I'll start with what I miss first. I miss the work. I miss the common united purpose against a particular goal or mission or aim. I do miss that, and I miss my colleagues. There's something about working for an organization that has a very clear, defined mission and purpose. I do miss that. What I have learned since my foray into where I am now, working with private companies, is that evidence has to be translated. Very much in the public sector, we present evidence. There is a fair degree of familiarity with evidence, or there are people who will do that translation for you. If you're working with organizations that don't have that capability, you have to be the translator. You have to connect to the purpose of that organization, and you have to connect with their why. So why do they need to take this evidence on board? And you can't have any judgments about that. You can advise, you can guide, and you can put it in perspective. But you can't say, well, I disagree with the fact that you're trying to add 30 million to your bottom line. I've learned that evidence still is primary, but there needs to be that translation into why is this important for this organization. So that was a good lesson for me.
What I was going to ask you about is values and behaviours and the relationship between the two, but also if one had a trumping, which would be the trump for you? Values, behaviours.
They're part and parcel of one another. They're twins. they're twins. It's interesting because culture in an organisation is about the things that that organisation values. And that drives a particular type of behavior. Okay. Behavior doesn't exist on its own. Behavior continues if it's rewarded. I think that's in terms of quotations and psychology. We always say behavior that is rewarded will continue. The values of that organization, team, individual tends to drive the behavior that we see. So they are linked, I'm afraid.
No, I think it's great to hear that. I strongly believe that too. You are what you promote.
Mm.
You see that in purpose-driven organizations as well, particularly, I think.
Absolutely, you do. Absolutely.
I'm a big fan, because I don't have the eloquence of others, to use other people's quotations. And I find they are really useful and often have greater meaning for the recipient than for me. Mm. I'm a collector of quotations. I love them. You're eloquent enough already to not need to go to others for their wisdom. But do you use quotations? And if so, do you have a favourite quotation that you find you use more than others?
I draw inspiration from many different people. I don't know if it's a quotation, but I know it's attributed to Maya Angelou, who is a fantastic poet, author, activist, writer. She said that the truth is that none of us can be free unless all of us are free. And I tend to live very much by that, because when we work for the most affected in an organization or in society, when we make it better for those people, everybody benefits, because it's better for everybody.
Belissa makes a powerful case that those who wear armour can carry an unnecessary burden. She encourages leaders to work out how to lighten their load. I loved her reflection about the importance of considering any initiatives through an intersectional lens. It was also fascinating to hear that evidence and research is often not enough. A translated narrative is vital for impactful change. Do share this episode with someone you think would benefit from what Belissa has to say. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can leave a review at Apple Podcasts, or if you're listening on Spotify, you can comment on the episode in the Spotify app. Take care until next time.